Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is episode 43, where we are continuing to discuss organizational centralization and decentralization using the Federalist Papers 9 and 10. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
So for the first two parts, we've sort of joined up into teams, and we each took a side. Again, it was Ralph and Pedro on the federalist / centralization side, promoting that view. And Demetrius and I were taking the anti-federalist or decentralization view. And we engaged in some pretty healthy debate here in the previous two parts. Here in part three, what we're going to do now is step out of character and kind of get a little bit more back to being ourselves and offer our own individual perspectives, along with providing insights, possible research agenda. We'll see where this goes. I'll just go ahead and start for myself, because I, for one, even though I was taking the decentralization side for the purposes of parts one and two, I'm actually rather ambivalent between the two. I have some strong views favoring both ways, and I actually almost favor the dialectic. And the reason why I say that is because, in a way, the tension between centralization and decentralization represents a lot of common views that's within the society at natural tension, and I'm kind of referring to the paradoxes of Marianne Lewis. And when she called them a paradox, it was basically that there's just a natural inherent tension between individual autonomy and collective identity. And this was actually reflected very well in the views of the Federalist Papers too, that those were just simple, natural human tensions. And the forces that sort of move us back and forth between centralization and decentralization are in and of themselves just a natural extension of the tension. And so the question becomes not so much whether centralization or decentralization is necessarily better, but what are the intentions behind it? That centralization is good if the purpose for centralization is good. And some of the arguments which were proffered by on the centralization side sort of showed that there are instances where we need to have a central view, a central image, some cases a central identity, in order to drive collective action. And, again, going back to my own military experience, there's a lot of instances where you really absolutely have to have that. Unity of effort, for example, is treated as a virtue with very, very good reason. And then on the other side, of course, there is that sense of, individual autonomy, the ability to dissent or to strike out on one's own, or all of those other forces, many of which were viewed as important manifestations of freedom that the United States was founded upon, and also that now we promote in terms of innovation to try to break complacency, if you will, that you need to have some sort of energy at the individual level to be able to challenge, to look for new ways in order to ensure that the organization remains competitive. So the bad side of both is also pretty evident. From toxic leadership to toxic followership, there's all sorts of different ways in which centralization or decentralization could equally be bad. So I kind of like there's an article by Andy Van de Ven and Poole, I forget his first name, back in 1995, and they talk about four motors of change, one of which is the dialectic, and that the dialectic occurs when you have two opposing forces who forge an uneasy and not durable synthesis. And at the point of synthesis is when change really occurs. And I think in even the same the examples that I was bringing up with the doctor and the sports analogy, that the points in which you have the two camps coming together in a synthesis is when the best time for change occurs. And that synthesis, as long as that synthesis isn't held durable beyond its usefulness, then it has the greatest chance of being good. When it ceases to be good, the two parties should separate and you do the cycle again and forge a new synthesis. And so that's kind of my view about the whole debate of centralization, decentralization.
Yes, I think that was a great summary of the major issues. I also like the dialectic aspect of this, and it was something that came clear to me by reading the Stephen Cumming article that the author so kindly shared with us, the centralization and decentralization. I love the title, The Never-Ending Story of Separation and Betrayal. So it almost sounds like a crime novel. And I think the one extra thing I was going to say about Tom's excellent point was I also think that paradox or the dialectic between the two opposing forces or perspectives is never going to be won by one side. You're going to have the synthesis and then you're going to have another. The Van de Ven and Poole article talks about you'll have a new paradox in the new change when you make that case. And I think based on our comments in parts one and two of this episode, we think that centralization and decentralization is never going to go away because those are fundamental themes in management and organizations. And I think they're one of the big challenges for organizations and is certainly worthy of further research is how do you recognize when, as Tom said, the synthesis isn't working for you any longer, right? That's one of the big challenges in organizations is they tend to stick with one way of doing things and see the whole world and environment in terms of that way of the synthesis that they created or that way of dealing with the world. And yet the world stubbornly changes on them and makes things more difficult. So I think that's kind of the crux of the research question there is how do you know your current, is it just profit? Is it just loss? Is it those kind of things? I mean, those are pretty obvious examples, but are there other ways you would be able to tell your means of having resolved that dialectic is no longer working?
I don't have an answer directly to that, but I just want to extend, I think, some of the points that Tom and Ralph are making, because I think especially Tom, you said something at some point about, centralization is good if, the purpose is good and so on and so forth. And of course, there's always a space for rethinking and trying to be attentive to change. And, Ralph was talking about this idea that's important to be able to, almost to have the diagnosis of what is happening and to change accordingly. But I just want to insist, and I think this is just underlying in what you both said, is that I think our discussion illustrates that the point is never whether centralization or not, decentralization or not. It's always how it happens. It's always to in which conditions and what kind of organization and to what purposes and who is involved, It's interesting that I think the more we debate these topics, I mean, I had the same feeling with the last episode about organizational learning. It's very difficult to talk about organizational issues in abstract because they really much depend on how the specific cases that we are trying to make sense, So it's hard when we try to make these big discussions on big issues, which of course are important. But then I think the more we go there, the more we realize that we need to go back to specific instances and think of what makes sense there.
Or go the other way and talk about fundamental principles and philosophies. It's either one or both.
Well, no, I think I want case by case more, but then that would be the topic for a different debate.
Yeah, it looks like Pedro's more in the specific case. Yeah. But I think Demetrius is right in some respects. I'm not disagreeing with you, Pedro, but I think he brings an extra, because you're on my team, right? So I'm not supposed to disagree.
Exactly.
With you, even though we stepped into character. I'm on your team, buddy. Don't worry. So I do like Demetrius's idea of going back to the philosophy and the theory and saying, does that help me now? Does that guide me for this particular case? So I do think that is, you don't want to make them all case by case kind of decisions. And that's why in organizations, there's a lot of value in having a mission and vision so people can get aligned as Tom was talking about from his prior experience. And so I always find the theory, it doesn't necessarily give me an answer, but it gives me a way to think about some of the things that the forces at play.
Right. Well, personally, I found this a bit challenging, our debate, primarily because I really am more leaning towards the centralization part.
I was the same way. I had to argue something I didn't fully believe in. So just for listeners out there to realize, okay, it's not just Demetrius said it, but I didn't always argue what the things I prefer.
I mean, there's a lot of value in taking up a position that you don't necessarily agree with and trying to argue for it earnestly, because you know that's one of the ways of understanding your biases or your prejudices, and also understanding the other side. So that's important. But at the same time, I found it really difficult to argue from principle, and the principle in our case being decentralization, because, well, that's a really unacademic way of approaching, you know, a subject matter, that I found it necessary to come up with arguments I wouldn't necessarily make, simply to support a point I don't necessarily support. So there's a certain conflict that was involved in this. And also it was really difficult to argue against Pedro, because I believe the things that, in the points that he made, are the same points that I would have made had this been, reversed.
One of the things that I found interesting in the papers we read is that a lot of the discussion is very much, I mean, a lot of the justification for the federalism and, you know, the new constitution and so on and so forth is very much on preventing, I think, conflict. There is a lot of this idea of, you know, they talk about factions and the possible factions that might emerge and, you know, insurrections and, you know, violence different between states and so on and so forth. It's interesting because when I think about centralization, especially thinking about the US, but also about organizations, I think there are always a layer of identity and culture and shared values. And I don't know, this almost like the structural side to something that exists on a more symbolic level, so to speak, you know. And then I was wondering whether this is a case of chicken and egg, because I don't know so well the history of the US, and maybe Ralph and Tom can help me here, but it's interesting to think that today there's a very strong national pride, but from the way that I read the papers, it seems that, you know, the country as we know didn't exist, so this thing didn't exist. And when I think about the organizations that I know, that I have studied or have worked in or just participated, that are very centralized, usually they also have a very strong kind of, you know, common symbolic, you know, sense of mission. And I mean, I think probably the military would be a great example, that I think this idea of unity doesn't come only for the formal structures, but also from a more symbolic kind of attachment, you know. So I was wondering how these things play out.
So I'll give you a couple of perspectives, and Tom can help me on the military side, but your point is really well taken, this idea about the identity. Was it national or local? And in the U.S. history, at this time, and even up through the Civil War, the people's identity was local. They identified with their town or their city or the area where they came from, and particularly their state. People didn't, even though the documents referred to the United States, that really wasn't how people had their personal identities. It was attached to, I'm a Virginian, I'm a Massachusetts person, I'm a Pennsylvanian, those kinds of things. And throughout the Civil War, it was that, because the armies were raised from the states. That's how they the armies were staffed, and they were all raised locally. And you could bring you could become a general if you raised a big enough army. It had nothing to do with military background or anything. So a lot of things have changed in the United States, and I'm serious. And in fact, there's a history of people having these very flamboyant uniforms. It's called the Zouave uniform, where these guys were going to battle with red turbans and these blue coats and white shirts and red pants. And both sides wore them. It was an Arabic uniform, and these guys, I guess, would raise divisions or battalions so they could outfit them in these uniforms. Very interesting. And so that's kind of a new thing that now we in the United States, the national identity is more transcendent than the local. And I'm not saying nobody has a local identity. It's just that's much more the dominant identity and just one example is Robert E. Lee. He was actually offered the command of the entire Union forces because he was a well-known general. He was in the army at the time of the Civil War, but he said, no, I can't fight against my home state. So he resigned his commission and then went to lead armies in Virginia. And Grant, at the time, he considered all of the the Confederate soldiers, with whom many of whom he'd served with, as traitors because they violated their oath to support and defend the Constitution. So that was a pretty big deal. And when people come into the military, that's one of the first things we do is spend a lot of time developing identification with the local unit. You know, we take for granted that they, to some extent, that they understand and accept the national identity. A lot of effort is put into developing that local pride and unit, and there's a lot of symbolism and ceremony that goes into that because it's very important for unit cohesion and effectiveness in conflict. So that's those things are very important. I don't know if Tom wants to add anything.
Oh yeah, and we kind of forget because again, you know, we sort of take for granted what we think of the United States nowadays because the United States has been basically the most powerful country for the past three quarters of a century. But in reality, you know, the sense of a national identity in the United States is a recent phenomenon. I mean, it kind of began to gel after World War I. You know, it's sort of there were phases before then, but it really became a forefront in World War I when the Americans moved from, you know, just being another country to taking a place on the world stage. And I would say that there are actually some significant pockets of the country that still retain more of a local identity than they do a national identity. It is a little bit different. And I think you can kind of put that in context with what was been happening in Europe since the institution of the euro, for example. You still have a lot of nations within Europe that have really maintained their national identity. So the citizens have maintained their national identity. But you also have now this common currency, and I can also put in, say, the Schengen travel zone, where the boundaries between nations are no longer policed to the same extent that it was before, which allows greater movement of people or what have you. And what has that done for the identities of the individual nations? It's kind of so what's going on there in Europe is kind of what we went through on the American side some time ago. And I think that now with the world changing the way it is, there's a lot of ongoing questions and debates as to whether or not, you know, European Union versus the individual sovereignty of a state. You know, the obvious example of that right now is the Brexit, the exit of the United Kingdom from the European Union. So it's an ongoing, you know, it definitely is an ongoing discussion at a multinational level.
Well, the European thing is unity through diversity, and diversity there being a key word because unlike the formation of America, which virtually began from scratch with the colonists, the European nations have a long history of mutual dislike and alterations and altercations. So the kind of the centralization drive for using the, if you will, individual identities and sovereignties as a binding mechanism is an ambitious idea at best. And so, I mean, friction is to be expected. But in so far as we talk about things like identity or technology, even something we didn't really quite touch upon, I think it's interesting to consider the effects of less obviously centralizing mechanism on on how organizations and societies work, specifically as we move into kind of a less physical realm of economy and organizations. How do things that seem to foster individualism and a difference and some form of decentralized organization are actually doing the opposite? How technologies, specifically thinking of algorithms, how these, whilst overtly serving a purpose of highlighting individuality and self-autonomy, are actually generating more conformity and more kind of centralized, less diverse situations, and how that is not really understood as well as perhaps it should be. Basically, centralization through decentralization, right? So where you have mechanisms that foster self-sufficiency actually operate to create systems with more monolithic architectures than ever before. And that's something that's very interesting to debate and continue debating as we kind of move into the coming years, when these systems will become more understood and more prolific in kind of organizations and societies.
Well, you know, what I find interesting about that approach to autonomy through algorithms is that, in a way, it's a centralized view of what the autonomy of the worker should be. Because whenever you see the defenders or the top leaders of these networked organizations like Uber or others like that, they're talking about what they think is good for the workers and what they think it helps the workers do. And we're discovering now that the workers have a different voice. They have their own voice. And they don't have a good mechanism for reconciling this top-down view of what the autonomy should be, and yet what the workers think it ought to be. Goes kind of back to Tom's points he was making about the sports leagues and stuff, where you have this structure that defines the interaction, and yet it's, you know, strange enough we're finding out the workers want something different, which I find an interesting paradox.
I haven't thought that before, but actually when you said it, Ralph and Dimitris, it's interesting how the case of technology and algorithms and the related kind of way it shapes work kind of complicates, because, you know, I wonder if we had as starting example Uber instead of the Federalist debate, how that would have shaped our discussion, because it's unclear whether centralization, decentralization, it's some people would argue that actually not centralized, because, you know, the algorithm is doing the thing and it's coordinating, there is no real center, but actually from a political perspective, you see decentralization, you know, so it's interesting how I think it is actually what Dimitris was hitting at. It is that centralization is not necessarily a very obvious thing. You know, it can happen in unexpected ways and unclear ways, and can be associated to different kind of mechanisms.
And that's all for part 3 of episode 43. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time here on Talking About Organizations.